Welcome to the Ion Basketball Podcast, the Pick and Troll Podcast. I'm your host, Zach Harper, live from Miami. Matt Moore, you're live from Memphis. This is our first on-site, double on-site podcast. How's it going?
Yeah, we're double teaming two different cities, which is how it ends.
Oh, well, that goes awkwardly into my how are the meat sweats treating you? You had some barbecue yesterday.
You know, so my day was kind of crazy, and I know that people listening to podcasts, people that follow writers, what they really are going for are the travel stories. Yes. So I'll totally tell this one, but I swear I'll keep this one quick. The game gets over at like 11:40 the other night, Tuesday night, and I have to do interviews and then get to the and then write up two different things for CBS, and then my hotel is actually about 40 minutes away. So I didn't get back to my hotel until about 2 a.m. Central Time.
Okay.
Well, they had told us that the Grizzlies were going to practice at noon in Memphis because they were leaving right after the game. And so to be a good soldier, I was like, my wife does my flight booking for me because apparently I'm a child that can't do it. And I was like, I need to be on a 6 a.m. flight to make sure I get there. I was like, I'm going to maximize my opportunities. I want to make sure I'm there for Grizzlies practice.
Right.
Roundabout story, you can fly into Memphis, but it costs like $1 zillion. So I had to fly into Little Rock and drive over. Guess where my connecting flight was, by the way?
Shouldn't that be short enough?
It should be, but it was not. It was the only way I could get to Little Rock was through a connecting flight. My connecting flight to get to Little Rock so I could drive to Memphis was through Memphis.
Wait.
Yeah. I'm on the road for 2 weeks, so I had to pack a bag, so I can't just, you know.
This is like going to a movie theater, and you show up to the movie theater, you buy the tickets, and then you drive to Blockbuster to buy snacks, and then you go back to the movie theater.
Exactly. That's exactly what it's like. And so that was annoying. And my mom's like, why don't you just stay there? I was like, well, my bag. And she's like, oh. And I was like, additionally, if you do not show up for your second flight, they get a little worried about you.
Yeah, they don't like that at all.
They're not fans of that. So, yeah. The result is I've got like 2.5 hours sleep plus like an hour on the plane, and I drive in from Little Rock. And after a hilarious instance in which I discovered that my hotel apparently is in one of the worst parts of Memphis.
Oh, lovely!
I told Twitter, I was like, "Oh, hey, I'm staying here. Where's a good barbecue place?" And they're like, well, here's some good barbecue places, but more importantly, you realize you're going to die, right? Because you're going to die. Well, it can't be that. I mean, well, I know Memphis is kind of sketchy. No, specifically where you are, you'll die.
The Blind Side 2, starring Matt Moore.
Right. So anyway, I wound up in another hotel. Thanks to everybody that gave me suggestions and provided me this tourist guidance to make sure I don't get hurt.
Have you seen The Blind Side?
Yeah.
Could they have picked any actor that looked more like Zach Randolph for the bad guy, like the bad guy gangster in the movie?
Zach Randolph.
It looked just like it, at one point it made me just wish that they had picked Zach Randolph.
I wonder if he'd do it. He probably would too. Zach loves attention, so.
Yeah, he would love that.
Anyway, so I get in and I'm staying in a place in Germantown, and there's a place here called the Germantown Commissary, which I hadn't been to yet. I've been to Rendezvous, I've been to Central, I've been to one other place I can't remember, but I'd never been to Germantown Commissary. So I was like, well, I guess because I couldn't check into my hotel to go pass out for a nap. So I go to the Germantown Commissary and sit down. Waitress comes over, very brusque, and she's like, what you want? And I'm like, I look at the menu, and I'm like, you know what? I realized I hadn't eaten in 24 hours. So I had a 3-meat platter of pulled pork. Yeah, of pulled pork, shoulder, ribs, and chicken.
Oh,
with bread pudding, and apparently one of their specialties are deviled eggs, and the deviled eggs were awesome. So it was incredible. I did not eat all of it, just to not make me sound like such a slob. I ate about half of it, and then brought it back and ate the rest of it last night for dinner.
Yesterday for lunch, I had a goat taco, which was
you said that
amazing and
sounds intriguing.
And I had this pulled pork taco. It's this place on Southeast 2nd Street in Miami called Reggae Tacos. It's a new place, or kind of new. It's, I think, like 3 or 4 months old. And it was opened by this bar that's next door. And it's, the tacos are incredible. Like, the pulled pork is really, like, juicy and tender and fits great, and they put mango on top of it.
Ooh.
Yeah, it was a great touch. And then the goat taco was just like some onions and a little like a couple other garnishes, but the goat meat's really good. I felt a lot like the T-Rex in Jurassic Park. Like I didn't want it served to me. I kind of wanted to hunt it after I started tasting it. but yeah, highly recommend Reggae Tacos.
I'm a big goat and lamb fan. That's one of my favorite meats.
Yeah, I love lamb. I've just never had I never had goat before, but I'm sold. It's a lot like beef.
Unlike most things which are like chicken, goat is like beef.
Yes. Speaking of chicken, there was a chicken move not to have Roy Hibbert. No, that's not true. Let's talk about last night's game. I get the strategy, and this was the hot topic on Twitter last night that everyone got really uppity about. But I get the idea of not bringing Roy Hibbert in at the end of the game with 2.2 seconds left because you're worried about a jumper. And I talked to Roy Hibbert about it after the game, and he understood. And he, like, legitimately understood. He was like, no, Bosch had been killing me with a mid-range jumper. I get doing that. Like, I totally get that. I accept it. Is that something like maybe I should speak up in the future because I would have loved to have been in there, but, like, I respect the decision by the coach. I back him 100%. Like, he was all for it. He was almost too professional about it, which maybe you want him to be a little angrier about it. But he explained it, and he understood, and he thought the strategy was fine, but he also wanted someone in there to protect the rim, and they didn't have that. Sam Young never rotated, and even if Sam Young rotates there, what's he going to do? I mean, I don't think there's any way he's stopping that. Paul George overplays it. LeBron drives the basket. There's no rim protection. People are saying, well, yeah, he would have kicked out to Bosch for the jumper, and then we're killing him for the jumper. It's like, I don't agree. Like, maybe, I mean, at least for me, I wouldn't want the star to beat me. I wouldn't want the best player in the world to have the ball, and if anybody else beats me, I think you live with that. Two, we're talking about LeBron James, who's 78% at the rim this year, and we're talking about Chris Bosh from where he was standing. He's 42%, 45% maybe, which is a good percentage. It's an excellent shot, but I'll take the 30% difference and with the game on the line.
I tend to overthink things in life. Just traditionally, I overthink things because I go through contingencies and overanalyze and spend too much time considering possibilities and trying to get in other people's heads and all of these things. And it's just something I constantly do. I overthink everything. And so I know it when I see it. And that was just overthinking it. Right. It's okay. Well, we're going to stop the layup. So now we've got to worry about stopping the jumper. All right. So we'll do this, this, and this to stop the jumper. But doing this, this, and this to stop the jumper means you just left the layup open.
Right.
Oh. And now,
and people, well, if Paul George doesn't overplay that, it's like, this is still a 5-on-5 game, correct? I mean, yes, that you can isolate things down to this guy didn't stop this man and that caused this chain reaction of events, but I just feel like you have to trust your rotations, and if you don't get to that jumper to contest it properly, then you don't get there, but you don't allow the lane to be wide open. I mean, that's what's the best shot in basketball is a shot at the rim, correct?
Yep.
So why give up the shot at the rim? I mean, the mid-range jumper is not a very good shot for a lot of guys. It is for Chris Bosh, and Frank Vogel talked about that at practice or at the shoot-around yesterday, talking about how I think his exact words were something like he shoots a ridiculous amount from mid-range. And so that's clearly on their mind, but I don't know. There are a lot of reasons they lost that game. There are a lot of things that went wrong on that final play. It was a great play. Spo said even if Hibbert was in, they were going to run the exact same play, and that it was the same play they had run before, or they were going to run before, but he just made it look a little different to start out, and it was a great play. LeBron had an uncontested layup, and I guess guys who aren't clutch can even hit uncontested layups for game winners.
Right. I mean, the logic here is pretty simple. Don't let LeBron get layups. That seems to me to be a pretty... don't let LeBron get easy layups, at
and
least.
Honestly, like, I really feel like if he kicks to Bosch there for a jumper because Roy Hibbert overcommits, the storyline is that LeBron's afraid of the moment still. Like, that would be the stupid storyline. We wouldn't be killing them for leaving Bosch open. Like, people would just instantly go, oh, why did LeBron pass that? You know, like, that's the stupid reaction that you get.
The other thing I keep wondering about with this whole, he would have passed it, there were 2.2 seconds left. He had the ball out of his hands at, like, 0.5.
Yeah.
So even if Hibbert's there, he drives, and Hibbert steps up to meet him, LeBron's passing with a second there.
Right, and I agree there. He's passing with it. Like, maybe, I think best case scenario, you get the ball to Bosch with a second left, and he has to get into a shooting motion. Not that it takes him a second to get a shot off, but that's a pretty bang-bang play. And it could cause Bosch to rush it. Like, we're still in a world of a lot of what-ifs here. But Kevin Arnovitz had a great point. He tweeted out this morning. He said, not to pile on, but sometimes risk aversion is the biggest risk, and which is what you just talked about, is that, oh, you're guarding against all of these things. Well, let's take away the jumper. Yeah, but then you leave the lane open. And I just feel like it's a weird strategy to not protect the rim with 2.2 seconds left. And some people were saying, you know, oh, in that situation, you switch everything. You try to force a contested jumper. I'm like, if there was a second left, I would completely agree. But 2.2 with LeBron James on the court is a lot of time. Like, that's too much time to think you're going to force a contested jumper no matter what. And clearly, if they're worried about him kicking to Bosch for a jumper, then they know that there's enough time to where he's probably going to the basket, right?
Here's what's amazing. I feel like the Pacers are getting killed more over this game than they would have had, like, without anybody really, like, understanding. Look, Paul George doesn't hit a double clutch 30-footer.
Right.
And Ray Allen doesn't miss a three when he's, like, a 95% free throw shooter. We're not talking about this play.
Right.
You know, like, they got things to go their way. They pushed. I wrote this last night. Like, it's a tough loss, but they needed a lot of things to go badly for them. They also needed a lot of things to go right for them.
Right.
But they got, to me, I look at it from the context of a series, and I'm about to get, I think, probably punished for this attitude, because if Spurs win on Sunday, I look like a moron. Or Saturday, I look like a moron. But I think in both series, they're trending towards what the underdogs want. Like, right. They've pulled them into – the Pacers took the heat and pulled them into an ugly, grinded-out, nasty game.
Yeah.
Do you want to steal that one? Yes. But the fact that you're able to look at that and go, look, what we did was successful. We had success in that game. Like, I that's how I would look at it now. They're competitors, and they're always going to be like, we want to win, there are no moral victories, blah, blah, blah. But if you're trying to set up the context of how a series win would go – this goes a long way towards that, I think.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I wrote this during the game and put it up on CBSSports.com, was how they were getting the Heat to play their style of game. Like, they were dictating pace. It was sloppy, but they were too sloppy. And that there's this fine line between, you know, just making a game completely ugly and making a game ugly and where you're not giving the other team a lot of chances. And they were doing that by turning the ball over and giving up points off turnovers. They, as the game went on, they seemed to correct that to where it wasn't such a big ratio of turnover to score. But the Pacers have to be careful. They have to find that sweet spot. I felt like they found that sweet spot, you know, in the fourth quarter, even in overtime, of making the game ugly but not just giving the ball away. Aside from George Hill almost giving the ball away to Norris Cole at the end. Which was a crazy play. But I do think that there is... I agree with your point that the Pacers should feel good about, even though it's a loss in the Eastern Conference Finals, I think you should feel good that you did get to dictate the way you played. Now, you lost that way, but you have to think that more times than not, if you get the game to be at your pace and your style, you're going to, you know, your consistency is going to win out.
I have a separate question about the final play. Why Sam Young? What's with the Sam Young thing doing now?
He was big on. He said that in shoot-around. He was asked about his options for defending LeBron. He was like, "Look, it's LeBron James. I mean, you know, there's only so much you can do. But I like what Paul George can do against him. I like what Sam Young. Like, he threw Sam Young in there really quickly, which I was surprised. I would have thought maybe he would talk up Stevenson a little bit, but he went straight to Sam Young. And was like, you know, I like those two options for defending LeBron as good as any two options. And I found that odd. I don't get Sam Young. You know, maybe Hansbrough, I can't remember if they switched it on that play, but Hansbrough ended up, like, just sticking to Ray Allen, which was great defense. I mean, he denied, that's what you want him to do. You don't want him to help off, like, you never help off Ray Allen, even if he's missing. You never help off him. But I'm surprised Hansbrough wasn't in there, because he's at least more of a weak side presence, right? Like, LeBron sees Sam Young coming. I don't think he's going to be deterred.
And Young just wound up just, like, watching him. Just like, oh, hey, what's up, bro?
Yeah, I think he realized he couldn't get over there in time, and it makes it look worse than it is, but there is a certain point where it's like, you're way too late to get over there, so kind of what's the point? You know, maybe yeah. Stick around and hope, but he wasn't boxing it. Like, there was no box out to be had, but he wasn't, like, sticking around to box out. He just got stuck in the middle. He was like, oh, there's a layup.
Oh, hey, there's LeBron going for a layup.
Yeah.
There's our hopes and dreams being crushed down the drain. Yeah, so I think I like what the Pacers did a lot. I thought that David West was great. You know, 26 points, 17 shots.
Yeah, West was incredible. I have a question for you. Should Miami feel good about it? Because they did get sucked into Indiana style, oh my God. If Eric Spoelstra says play our game one more time, he said that about 100 times in the pregame conference. Like, he just, I know it's a very Pat Riley thing. It's like, play our game. We have our identity. We want to play our game. But they didn't play their game. They played Indiana's game, and they still won. Should you feel good about adapting like that? I don't even know if adapting is the right word, but should you feel good that you won out that way? Or do you feel kind of a little lucky and a little reprieved to be like, hey, we kind of stole one on our own home floor. We need to play better.
The Pacers had more fast break points than the Heat.
Yeah.
When the Pacers had 20 turnovers.
Yeah.
20 turnovers and you've got 11 fast break points. You know, it's not about the points out of the turnovers. For the Heat, you need to translate turnovers into fast break dunks. That's what you do. That's where you're strongest.
Definitely.
Like, you make this into a boat race. That's how you win, because you're superior. You're the superior athlete, the superior machines. You make this into a boat race. That's how you beat them. And so I honestly, to a certain degree, I don't think the Heat have to be necessarily concerned, because they can win a tough, gritty game.
Yeah.
They have the defensive principles. Like, the Spurs, I don't think can win if Memphis drags it back into their...
Into the mud.
Like, the Spurs can't win in the mud. They can't do that.
I think you should just walk around downtown Memphis all day, just walking up to people, go, we in the mud.
Are you in the mud? We in the mud. Zach Randolph the other night, I'm a little worried about, I'm going to practice today and tomorrow. We'll see where their heads are at. Grizzlies were not in a good place emotionally on Tuesday night.
I would like to know how, I keep just referring back to this, but it does seem so similar to me, I would like to know, like, where their mind is at right now compared to where their mind was after game two against the Clippers.
I asked that question specifically.
Okay.
I feel good now because I asked a good question.
Well, I don't know that me thinking of it makes it a good question.
Mike Conley, I talked to Mike Conley for a few minutes and I was like, what was the locker room like after that loss? And he's like, upbeat and confident. He's like, we really felt like we had the game right there, and that we were, you know, we felt like we had played better and just hadn't executed a few things, and that the series is really going our way. And I was like, well, everybody in this locker room is really down. Like, Tony Allen was literally muttering to himself, gotta get better, gotta get better. Like, Zebo is just a sad puppy dog.
Yeah.
There was a lot of frustration in that locker room after game two. And I was like, so what's the difference? And he said, we really feel like we could just play so much better. We're frustrated with how we've played. Yeah. We don't feel... He's like, give credit to them. They've been amazing, but we just are so frustrated with the fact that we've let it get like this because we haven't played as well as we know we can. So I think a lot of it is they felt like they played well in Game 2 versus the Clippers and lost, versus they felt like they played badly in Game 2 versus the Spurs and lost.
Yeah, they didn't really start playing their game, their identity, until... kind of like the end of the third quarter. So I
midway through the third is when they that's when they kind of put the identity on it. So you know, the Spurs won. If we count overtime, which I kind of don't, because it was kind of a toss up, just overtime.
Overtime's a weird thing to analyze.
Right. Yeah, I'd say that the Spurs have won 6 of the first 8 quarters.
Yeah, I would agree with that. Third quarter in game 1, fourth quarter in game 2.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, I think that that's really concerning for. It's obviously really concerning for Memphis, but
are you worried about Zach Randolph, or is it you want to kind of see how he starts out in game 3 at home? Because that's where I'm at. Is he hasn't played well. He's played really poorly, especially by his standards. But I think I'm not terribly worried about him, because I do believe the home crowd fuels him and gets him momentum going.
He's missed a lot of chippies.
Yeah.
Game 2, he got going a little bit more, and it was a little bit more of what they want to do. And I think the big thing in that game, as far as Zach is concerned, he had 18 shots.
Yes.
It was one thing when he was 2 of 8 in game 1. That means he's not getting looks. You know, he was 6 of 18 in game 2. Randolph's not going to miss as many as he did. He's just not.
Right.
And if he does, they'll lose, and okay, that's fine. And people can call him a joking choker who chokes or whatever.
What's a gigantic, like one of those oversized pumpkins? Oversized pumpkin salt, maybe, or something like that?
There you go. He missed. There were so many. He joked about it. He was like, "They're like, are the rims a little tight?" And he was like, "These are the tightest rims in the world."
I like that a guy can joke about that performance a little bit, because I think that you kind of have to have that mentality. Like, you can't. It's not like blowing it off and not taking it seriously, but you have to be able to look and be like, "God, I just missed a lot of easy shots."
There was one in game 2 in the second half where Zebo does one of the little, it's a layup, and it goes up and to the side and then down inward and then pops back up and then back down and then to the side and then pops right back out. And then Tony Allen gets a hand on it and tips it, and the ball rattles in and out 5 times again.
Yeah.
And then comes out. That sequence was like, that is an impressive series of misses. And again, here's the very odd thing: for as much of a apocalyptic person for the Spurs, and maybe this is a bad sign because they won whenever I was, pessimistic, I'm really fine with where the series is at. I think it's totally okay. I have a lot of confidence that Memphis is going to win games 3 and 4. Yeah. I just feel like so many things did not go their way, and they made enough adjustments. And part of it, no one wants to talk about this, but Tony Parker was 2 of 8 in the fourth quarter and had no assists.
Yeah, he killed in the first 3 quarters, and then he just looked exhausted. Like, he couldn't work to get open, to get quick open shots, and Memphis pounced on that, which was, I thought the way they played him in the fourth, like, maybe they saw he was exhausted and knew that they could be more aggressive or whatever, but he was really bad down the stretch.
And like 2 things. One, I want to make very clear, watching him the first 3 quarters, the first 7, I guess the first 7 quarters of the series essentially, has been one of the most joyful experiences of my life watching basketball. He's good, even though he's slicing up a team I like, he's just been that good.
Yeah.
It's just been, this whole experience, I've covered the finals before, but the series has been just such a real, I've been really honored to be covering the series, just because I'm on the floor watching one of the best point guards, not like top 5 all time, but one of the best point guards, if we expand the conversation to 20, 10 or 20 of all time, and watching him just dissect, and he's making passes that they're catching the Spurs off guard because it doesn't seem like he can make them, and he's going so fast and he's so aggressive. It was really great. That said, man, I tried so hard to pull the Grizzlies into a quote on it, and no one would bite it. They all paused to think about it, and then just said, "Nope, he had a great game. He's an all-star." They all thought about it and wouldn't go for it. But I talked to one person off the record, who said, look, that's the strategy.
Yeah.
That's, you know, our thing is Tony's going to play great, but our defense doesn't hit you the first time. It's that 20th time.
Right.
That you come off that screen and we're there again, and it exhausts you and it wears you out. And we'll have to see how he does physically, because this is a really, you know, I also will tell you, they didn't say this. This is my prediction. Tony's going to spend a lot of time on his ass in game three. They're going to start fouling hard. Like,
I think they have to do that.
They have so much respect for this team. They really do. But at some point, Memphis is just going to be like, you know what? Going to have to let him know. Right. Going to have to let him know he can't get those layups. And he'll keep driving because it's Parker and he's aggressive, but it will take a physical tear on his body, too. So that'll be really interesting. We're doing a shorter podcast today because of we're both on the road.
I've got something before we go, but go ahead.
Oh, somebody wanted to know, several people requested me on Twitter that we talk about the Dwight situation.
Okay.
And how that's all playing out, because we didn't get a chance to talk about it. David Mammon of ESPNLA.com, a reporter that you and I both respect a lot, reported that, and you can, I'm just telling you, you can trust Dave. Dave's really good. Yeah. We wouldn't bring it up if you couldn't trust it. That Dwight Howard met with Lakers officials and said that he expressed frustration with Mike D'Antoni over how everything went down. And Lakers fans got a little sensitive over me making fun of that.
Really?
They were not fans.
That doesn't sound like that.
They were not fans of me making fun of you know, Dwight, because my first thing was, you know, Dwight's got a really good chance to kill four coaches in a year, and that's more than Darren. That's really impressive.
That's really unprecedented. I mean, that's, I think if you have that within striking distance, you have to take that chance to kill a fourth coach. You just do.
You do. That's, I mean, that's not, how many times do you in history, it's like going for the scoring record. Like, how many times in history, you know, how many guys can really say that they've killed four coaches inside of a year?
Exactly. Kobe is so close to really getting to the top of that scoring list. Like, you kind of just want him to drag it out a little bit and see if he can get there, because even if it looks awkward at the end, it's about the collective. And with Dwight, if you can get a fourth coach in a year, I mean, that's stuff legends are made of. That's like gladiator stuff right there.
And people get mad. They're like, you're really going to blame him for Bernie Bickerstaff? And I responded with, hey, he can only get the coaches in front of him fired. He doesn't get to choose who he gets fired.
Oh, my God.
Ken Berger, CBSSports.com, reported over the weekend, you know, never got a chance to talk about how he's concerning Houston. And Dallas are both very much on the list, which they expected to be. And people are like, why is this news? And the answer is because you knew that they were going to make a run at him. You didn't know if he would care, because right. Dwight could very easily leak out to his agent, which, you know, he's fond of doing, and say Dwight doesn't like Houston. He's not interested. He doesn't feel like that's his kind of team. Put that team out of your minds.
Right.
And instead, it's there's significant interest there. There's a report coming out of L.A. this morning that the Golden State Warriors are on his list as well. Which is kind of an interesting
idea.
I don't know how they get it done, considering the cap situation.
Well, it would have to be a sign and trade for, I would assume, Bogut and Barnes, right?
But they can't do the sign and trades because the Lakers are on the tax. They're on the luxury tax.
They're a repeater, yeah. Well, so Dwight's going to take the minimum. That's the only explanation. That would really, I mean, show us what you made of, Dwight.
He would be a hero to people. People would be like, sure.
No, I think people would still find a way to be annoyed with it because it's Dwight Howard.
Right.
I would still probably find a way to be annoyed with it.
Do you like the idea of him in Houston? Because I'm not crazy about it.
Oh, I do. I know he's an affliction wearer, but he's still awesome. Like, he's not perfect. He's not great in the all-time sense, but he's still really awesome. And I think guys like Stan Van Gundy, I think guys like Kevin McHale are good for him. Like, when is he going to tell Kevin McHale? Kevin McHale was a better player than Dwight Howard is.
Yeah.
You know, Kevin McHale was a dominant post scorer who was one of the best players in the world on one of the best teams ever. Kevin McHale isn't going to care what Dwight wants in terms of, like, Dwight demanding this, demanding that. And maybe Houston would bend to Dwight and after a year and McHale get kicked out of there or something, but McHale's never going to care. And I think that's the type. That was the thing. Stan Van Gundy didn't care. what Dwight's ego wanted. He knew what was best for the team, and I think McHale's the same way. He's not the same tactician that Stan Van Gundy is, but in terms of a motivator and a guy who kind of, like, I think McHale's very good at weeding out those type of players that can't take that hard love, you know?
Yeah, for me, it's just more of a style fit. I guess if you reconsider the Rockets and you say there's a good chance that they can play effectively in a half-court set when they slow it down, because he's not going to want to run that much.
Right.
He's never wanted to run that much. So.
But that's something where, like, secondary options coming off transition, their mismatches, it actually, to me, it looks just first glance, like, it looks like it could be very similar to the Orlando style since they shoot so many threes.
Right.
And you get them in a pick and roll and stuff. I mean, I think it would be a great move for him. I still think LA is probably the right choice just for the simple fact that over the years, I think it's going to be easier to build a winner because that's just what they do, right? But I do, like, I think Houston would be a great option for him.
Yeah, I'm not crazy, but everyone brings up the Sheik thing, and I'm like, no, you can work around that. You can figure that out. That's fine.
Yeah,
but
you could trade a Sheik. Like,
yeah, you don't ever go. Well, but they already have a Sheik. That's not an answer to not get Dwight Howard.
Right. that's a weird roadblock to put up.
You know, and maybe James would be a better fit for him as the alpha dog, because yeah. James isn't so intense that he's gonna annoy him the way Kobe did.
Yeah.
James would just be like, that's Dwight. Dwight gun Dwight. That's cool. Whatever.
And not that, I mean, Kobe definitely through stretches showed a very willingness to pass the ball and stuff. But I think James Harden is a more willing passer on the pick and roll, mm-hmm. which I know Dwight isn't crazy about running because it's his most efficient way of scoring. But, I mean, why would you want easy buckets? But I think that James Harden is a better player if they're going to run that kind of style in terms of like a tandem. Like working together as a tandem, as opposed to like Kobe and Dwight just seem to kind of exist together, and maybe they just need time to build the chemistry. I don't know.
I was told that Dan Fagan, his agent, was not the one to leak this report. By the way,
interesting.
So if it was somebody who's close to him, but it was not his agent.
Huh.
So. Which, I mean, it could be. I was just told that, and people lie to me a lot. So,
I've been lying throughout this whole podcast. I'm not even in Miami.
What a twist!
I mean, what's
an M. Night Shyamalan film?
Before we go, I just briefly want to talk about how bizarre the Miami basketball scene is. And this isn't.
I'm just gonna let you go. I'm gonna let you go. Go with it.
Yeah, this isn't a. This isn't like, oh, they don't have real fans or anything. That place was loud last night. American Airlines Arena, I think that's what it's called, was really loud. I was really impressed by how kind of effective the crowd seemed, because it doesn't really translate on TV. Like, I've watched games where you can tell, like, the crowd's into it, but it never really seemed that effective. But it was legitimately loud in there. It's just the pomp and circumstance of everything is bizarre. I mean, it is... I mean, they have a nightclub in the arena, and it feels like a nightclub. Like, the arena itself feels like a nightclub. Everyone's wearing, you know, weird, like, white jeans and all, you know, the whole, like, get-up. They've got this DJ who's... The DJ was good, but it's this constant, like, reminder that there is loud music and there's stuff going on. There's cameras. There's celebrity cams. There's through the robot cam. There's the other dance cams. I thought it was a fun experience, and for me, it's not my personal taste for going to a game. Like, it was a little too overproduced, and I think it's a little much, but for, like, the Miami culture, it fits, and I get why fans would love going to games because of that. I do have to say, by the end of the game, and maybe just because it was a very long game, it was, like, I don't know, 3.5 hours long or something, I did want to blow my brains out. Like, there was a certain point where there was too much going on, and I thought... This is, I feel like I'm being clockwork orange here, because I felt like the only way, like, they were taping my eyelids open, just like, look at all of the plastic, look at everyone with this weird tan and this weird hair gel, like, that's how it felt. But this was an instance in which I don't know how a beat writer could take that for 50, 60 games a year, just because it's not conducive to working. It's conducive to being a fan, and that's what they should be aiming for. But kudos to any beat writer who is covering this team every home game, because there's got to be a certain point where you just become Jack Nicholson in The Shining, and you just start busting through doors with axes. It's just fascinating. I'm actually excited to go to game two because I want to see if that will carry over into the next game, because I don't know if this is a consistent thing for them and it just doesn't translate on TV or what, but if you have a chance to go to a game in Miami, it's fascinating. The people watching alone is incredible.
I've likened it to, it's a lot like a mid-90s, early 2000 rap video.
It is.
That's what it feels like to me. Like,
I feel like Mystical should be the MC.
It feels like, I'm trying to remember what the one was. It was one of the ones with, he was still Puff Daddy then, and Mace.
Yeah, Money Mace.
One of those videos. That's what it feels like to me.
That was Money Mace after he was Murder Mace.
Right.
Which was always a fun time. I will say, the PA announcer, he gets a bad rap on Twitter. It's deserved. He's pretty insufferable. It's not the Dos Minutos thing is the least of it. Like, there was a basket that got, I think, waved off because of an offensive foul by the Pacers, or maybe it wasn't continuation. But he hit, and like the shot went in, and the PA announcer goes, "No basket!" Like, it was a weird thing, and it like everyone on Media Row was like, "Really? Is this guy serious?" And I know it's for the fans, but it was almost Simpsons-esque.
I've just basically resigned myself to the fact that I like bad PA announcers. Okay. This is all I can really come up with, because everyone loves Lawrence Tanter of the Lakers, and I think he's the worst. I just can't stand the way he does it with the so understated. It's like insulting to me. It's like, oh, okay, let's not anyone get excited at all. Let's just, hello, everyone. Welcome to the Los Angeles Lakers. Basket, Kobe Bryant. Hello. Ascent to your, to our domination. Like, it's terrible. And I like the Grizzlies guy, who a lot of people loathe.
Oh, I like him. I mean, I haven't experienced the game in Memphis, but just from TV, I like him.
Rick Trotter, who's I know on Twitter, nice guy. I get a lot of people there like, does he have to growl? And I was like, it's the Grizzlies in Memphis. Like,
and maybe that's hypocritical of me for whatever the Miami guy is. I don't know his name, but like, you are trying to play to the crowd a little bit, and I get that. But it was just that was the final straw, was the no basket. He like really, really elongated it. It was obnoxious.
My favorite call from the Miami PA announcer is his stand up.
Oh yeah, that was
your Miami Heat.
Yeah, they did. I think it was in the fourth quarter, maybe it was overtime, but they like showed a close up of him on the screen yelling at people. I was like, is this necessary? This seems like a weird decision to make from a production standpoint. And I know it probably got old fast, but I cracked myself up every time he said Dos Minutos, and I just asked on Twitter, how many minutos? It's the little things that just crack me up. I'm not very intelligent. I'm very easily amused.
I'm not very witty. I'm just kind of here to...
Very easily amused.
Okay, well, we'll hopefully be back tomorrow, depending on how our technical situation works out. I'm not getting killed in Memphis. Zach is enjoying goat tacos. We'll have more continuing coverage from you from the conference finals, as well as the coaching searches and all that stuff. So,
enjoy Memphis, man.
Enjoy Miami. Thanks. Zach, it's an interesting place.
It's a great place. Thank you.